Affleck makes Charlie simultaneously lazy, acute, hard-nosed, and gentle. And the timing in his line delivery is phenomenal. The great Ty Burr. Arguably my favorite film critic from Ty Burr's watch list, which Chris Cody finds a little pompous, but I'm telling you, it's a great read. He's got some great stories about Ben Affleck. The Tender Bar is one of the films that we're reviewing this week. It is, in fact, our featured review. It's available right now on Amazon Prime. Good news, Cody did watch it. Also, Swan Song, which is available on Apple Plus. Excellent film from the great Mahershala Ali. And The Lost Daughter, Olivia Colman stars. That film is available on Netflix. That's the new. The old is Ted. That's right, 10th anniversary of Ted. How about A Talking Bear, played by Seth MacFarlane? Pretty funny movie. I enjoyed it. We'll talk about it. And as far as the wild card is concerned, that's right. At long last, my top 10 films of 2021. It's always something I take a lot of pride in. I know people, I hope, look forward to it. So I'll give you my top 10 movies of 2021. I know we're now January 13th, but it takes a little week and a half here because there's a lot of overlap of the movies. And by the way, a couple of films I still haven't seen. Next week, I'm going to review The Tragedy of Macbeth, which is available on Apple Plus January 14th. Denzel Washington, Frances McDormand, Joel Coen. That might be a top 10 movie. Who knows? But I'm going top 10 right now, and we'll go from there. Cody, how are we feeling? COVID impacted you, your wife, your daughter. Are we back to full health?
I'm feeling great. I got to watch a movie. I'm so excited for this. We got a new year, a new fresh start. You got your old top 10, but you're starting your new one. You know, I just like, what a time for year in movies.
It is awesome. And by the way, I didn't even mention, I slept on the big wild card here, Chris Mundy. He's the showrunner for Ozark, right? People love Ozark. New season coming out. The great Jason Bateman, Laura Linney. We're going to talk to the showrunner, Chris Mundy. Cannot wait to talk to him, get his thoughts on the new season of Ozark. Normally we go with the new reviews, and then we go the old and the wild card, all the rest of it. But I kind of want to start on a morbid note. Death, unfortunately, is a pretty popular topic. Last week, how many people died, Chris?
Last week, we had Betty White, John Madden, which we talked about. We also had Dan Reeves from the NFL. So that was like, you know, they say it comes in threes.
Yeah,
so that was last
more
week.
Death coming in threes. Sidney Poitier, the first great black actor. The guy won the Academy Award for Lilies in the Field. 1967, one of the all-time heavyweight years by an actor. To Sir with Love, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, huge box office hit, Best Picture nominee, Spencer Tracy, Katharine Hepburn, and then In the Heat of the Night, which I think is the best of the three. Rod Steiger won an Oscar for Best Actor. All came out in 1967. That solidified Sidney Poitier as the biggest box office, most popular actor in America. He unfortunately passes away, and all I had to tweet that day was, "They call me Mr. Tibbs." Of course, it's a mortal line in the film, In the Heat of the Night. Great actor. His backstory is fascinating. Grew up in the Bahamas, went to New York, wanted to be a stage actor. Didn't so much face racism. I'm sure he did. But one of the people there said, "You got to lose the accent. You sound like a Bahamian actor." Okay, fine. I'll lose the accent. He comes back, and it was guns blazing from there. Obviously an incredible actor. Righteous, commanding screen presence. It's a shame there's only been ever two actors who are African-American to win Best Actor. Sidney Poitier and Denzel Washington. When Denzel went for Training Day, Poitier got an honorary Oscar that year as well. I believe it was 38 years later. 1963, he won for Lilies in the Field. Denzel won for Training Day in 01. So that was obviously a great moment to see Poitier recognized there. The other one all of our audience will know is Bob Saget, the great comedian who had never really fit. The guy was on Full House as Danny Tanner, America's Funniest Home Videos, which made an art format of guys getting hit in the gonads. But he was a great comedian. If you asked anybody, like, dude, Saget is raunchy. Like, he is offensive. Like, if you've ever seen the movie The Aristocrats, which is a bunch of comedians telling a dirty joke, they go, Saget's as dirty as it gets. So it was always funny. He was known as Danny Tanner, of course, doting father to the Olsen twins, but also just a ruthlessly profane and funny comic, dead at the age of 65.
That's my sitcom dad. I mean, that is just my sweet spot. Full House, growing up, watching it. That one, you know, I've had a few celebrity deaths that really actually punched me in the stomach, and that was one of them. I'm actually, you know, not to be this guy, but we like met him at the studio, and nice. He was just so genuinely nice. Like, Stu Gatz made him, we always made fun of Stu Gatz for making him do a video to his daughters, but apparently, like, years later, he would like reach out to Stu Gatz, "Hey, how are your daughters doing?" And that is like, Stu Gatz is not like, you know, an A-list. So, you know, if he's doing that with Stu Gatz, you heard a lot of stuff about, because when people die, you always hear he's the nicest guy, but about Bob Saget, that seems to be like just genuinely nice along with a raunchy comedy act. Like, that is just the perfect combination right there.
I can't believe
it's like Adnan. It's like Adnan, cool. The nicest guy ever, but he also works blue. It's like when you have that kind of balance as a person, it's the kind of guy I want to hang out with.
It's a perfect way to bring it full circle. I'm very Saget-esque in my public persona, and then right. The fact I have an undercurrent of pervert, as Dan Levitar once said of me. Unfortunately, passed
I
with
once
the age
sucked
of 65.
Dick for Coke.
Thank you. They were bringing up dirty work. When people are like, "Wait, what movie did you do?" Dirty Work. I believe the exact line is I suck cock for crack. And
well,
I
no.
I'm sorry, this is the wrong meeting.
I'm talking about Half Baked. In Half Baked, he shows up
I said Dirty Work.
I think it's I Suck Dick for Coke. We'll have to look it up. We'll have to get the right.
Let's hope this is going to be the subject of the podcast heading this year. Okay,
oh,
in honor of Bud. Not sure Cody can pull away that away.
Oh, God.
And one more, if you'll recall, I recently raved about The Jinx, which is a 6-part HBO series that came out a few years ago about Robert Durst, and it's incredible. And I reviewed it, gave it 4 Maple Leafs. I don't want to spoil it now for you, but Robert Durst, you should watch The Jinx, no matter what, even if you know what happened. And you should know what happened because the guy just died, and you will know what happened because you see one of the obituaries about him. But the fact that that documentary ends with him saying, what have I done? We talked to James Andrew Miller, of course, wrote the HBO book. He raved about the documentary, what Andrew Jarecki did. He just died at the age of 78. Okay, I'll spoil it. Because of the documentary, he gives up the fact on a hot mic that he admits that he killed these people. And they then use that documentary as evidence. Andrew Jarecki, character witness, the guy got in prison. He got away with 3 murders, ended up being convicted of one. He served 6 months. He just died at the age of 78. Imagine, Chris, you lived your whole life. You've murdered several people. You end up fessing up on a documentary unwittingly. You served prison 6 months and then died. Like, pretty, got off pretty easy.
I mean, if you're going to just be in prison, you might as well.
He's done. Robert Durst, Bob Saget, Sidney Poitier, quite the trio. They say death comes in threes. One other story about Bob Saget. You know how much I love Gary Shandling. The great Judd Apatow documentary, The Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling. Again, to Chris's point about Bob showing a different side of himself, he gets emotional and choked up. He said, I was very close to Gary, but I was close to Brad Gray, who was Shandling's agent. And he goes, when they had that falling out, it was almost like Gary wouldn't talk to me anymore because like I wouldn't take his side. He was like, listen, dude, like you're a close friend of mine. Brad is my agent and a close friend. Why can't I be friends with both? But he goes, it always really, really upset me that Gary kind of just cast me aside, and I wish I could have made it up to him. I wish I could have said I'm sorry, like I'm not picking sides. So it was, there's a lot to Bob Saget more than you realize. He's a lot more than just Danny Tanner. But obviously, rest in peace to him and his family. Very, very sad news coming. He had just tweeted, I think, the night before. He'd done some stand-up.
About Betty White. Night. Like, I think yeah. He gave a really nice thing. I said a bunch of stuff about Betty White, and it's just terrible.
It's sad. All right, let's do the top 10 list. Every year, this is how we do. Number one, you know, let's not do number one. Let's go number 10 to one, right? Build up the drama, as they say. Number 10, it's a must have at least one movie from my beloved gangster genre, so what's better than the OG and David Chase? The prequel to The Sopranos, The Many Saints of Newark, Alessandro Nuvolo, a.k.a. the brother from Face Off, bye, bro, finally has a lead role to sink his teeth into, and Michael Gandolfini pays homage to his sui generis father, of course, the great James Gandolfini. Vera Farmiga as the haranguing Livia Soprano steals the show, even if Corey Stoll's Uncle Jr. gives the movie its big twist. The Many Saints of Newark is number 10.
All right, so I've seen that one. I want to play this game. How many of these movies have I seen? So I'm one for one. I'm thinking I'm going to have seen 3 tops.
I encourage you to chime in after every review. Number 9 is Encounter. Riz Ahmed, the first Muslim actor to ever be nominated for Best Actor at the Academy Awards, follows up The Sound of Metal with this father and son sci-fi curiosity. You have a sense the filmmakers are making up the story as they go along, but Ahmed's intensity and pathos are put to good use as a loving father who may not even realize he's lost his mind. Number 9 is Encounter.
We're still at 1.
Number 8 is Nobody. Got to have at least one action movie on my list. It comes from the actor you least expect it from. Better Call Saul's Bob Odenkirk. A modern-day Charles Bronson turned Michael Douglas and falling down, Odenkirk's lead isn't going to take it anymore, and the result is a propulsive, highly entertaining shoot-em-up.
Still at 1.
Number 7, Lin-Manuel Miranda's musical Before Hamilton is the second musical which makes my list. In the Heights, a soaring ode to Washington Heights, the Bronx neighborhood populated by Puerto Ricans and Dominicans. It's about the immigrant experience and travails that all minorities can relate to. As usual for Miranda, the songs and wordplay are awfully impressive, along with the skill of director John M. Chu. Does an excellent job directing this work.
I'll let you know if I've seen one.
Fair enough. Number 6. Mass. This is the kind of movie independent film connoisseurs seek out and relish. Two sets of parents meet to deal with their grief. One of their children has been murdered by the other. Astute about the nature of grief and topical in the wake of school shootings, there are 4 powerhouse performances on display, including cinephile guest with piercing blue eyes, Jason Isaacs.
Oh, so much charm. I've yet to get over all the charm that guy gave.
One of our best guests we've had here on Cinephile. Number 5, Muhammad Ali by Ken Burns. Rumble, young man, rumble. Leave it to the finest documentarian alive in Ken Burns to unearth more fertile material about the most analyzed and scrutinized athlete of the 20th century. Ali has all the sports stuff covered, shaking up the world against Sonny Liston, the rumble in the jungle, the thrill in Manila, but also the third heavyweight fight against Spinks in 78, and the torture of Holmes and Burbick. But Ali really hits home in the personal tales of wives and daughters, a magnanimous, charitable man who is also a relentless womanizer, eventually pursuing redemption through his latter stages as a devout Muslim and an ambassador for all of mankind. Ali from Ken Burns.
Not sure how I feel about documentaries being considered a movie. This seems like two different things.
We got one gangster movie, we got one action movie, we got one documentary. We're spreading it around
right,
here, okay?
All right.
Number four, the end of the year sees a crush of awards bait, but this time famed directors swung and missed. The incomparable Paul Thomas Anderson, one of my favorites, made the aimless and self-indulgent Licorice Pizza, while Guillermo del Toro followed up his Oscar-winning masterpiece The Shape of Water with the gorgeous but clunky Nightmare Alley. So leave it to that old war horse and close friend of Martin Scorsese, Steven Spielberg, to bring the lumber. Delayed a year due to COVID, his reimagining of the Best Picture winner from 60 years ago, West Side Story, is rapturous, luscious, big-screen entertainment. With his usual cinematographer, the ace Janusz Kaminski, the two-time Oscar-winning filmmaker keeps his camera static to allow us to enjoy the sights and sounds on display. The dazzling choreography and passionate, swooning performances from Golden Globe Award winners Rachel Zegler and Ariana DeBose. It's a throwback to old-school filmmaking, but also a timely story. More racially aware, less stereotypes, but still a heartfelt ode to Romeo and Juliet. Number four, West Side Story.
Still at one.
Number three, it's a shame that Academy Award-winning filmmaker Tom McCarthy gives Matt Damon the role of a lifetime, and it barely caused a ripple. Stillwater earned a standing ovation at the Cannes Film Festival, but was largely ignored in America upon its debut in July. See it for Damon going Gary Cooper, stoic, imbued with a sense of decency, but also the deeply flawed sense of justice. It's a busy plot, but character-rich depictions from McCarthy, who made Spotlight, Win-Win, and The Station Agent should be savored. Number three, Stillwater. Number two, Kenneth Branagh's joyous and poignant ode to his childhood, Belfast, is a reminder that while every story may have been told, including a come-of-age story set in Ireland during Protestant-Catholic fighting, it's the way that the story is told that makes all the difference. The best cast of the year, Ciaran Hinds, Judi Dench as the doting grandparents, Jamie Dornan, Katrina Balfe as the parents struggling to make ends meet, and Jude Hill as the precocious young lead. It's a heartfelt story. Number two, Belfast. And the best picture of the year, Farhadi Does It Again. Another riveting rumination on the nature of truth and a morality play on a prisoner with good intentions doomed to a potentially ruinous tale. Where so many filmmakers start out promising and falter, the Iranian master sticks the landing with a note-perfect conclusion. It's the Russian doll of filmmakers, and it's a brilliant film. I've seen it twice, and it is remarkable. Number one, a hero from Oscar Farhadi, former guest here in Cinephile. There is your top 10 of the year.
It's a good list. I saw one of them. You came out hot. You gave me the first one, so I'm like, all right, there's got to be a couple more in here. And man, but yeah, those are... I remember, like, you reviewed most of those, and that was, I thought maybe Sing 2 had a chance for number one,
yeah.
But I was like, I guess it's a Farhadi.
I try to get every, like, an animated film in there. If I had to, maybe I'd go with Luca. If you recall, I did review that. The one that might win the Oscar is Mitchell versus the Machines. Your daughter's probably a little young for it. I think it's more like 9, 10-year-olds, but whatever. We're going to do our Oscar recap later on. There is your top 10. I had texted Chris I'd also do a bottom three. I couldn't really do it except for the one that really stood out to me, which was the worst movie I saw all year. That is The Jesus Rules. Witless and unnecessary, a spinoff of The Big Lebowski, John Turturro's labor of love. He stars, wrote, produced, and directed, simply ends up being laborious. The wonderful Bobby Cannavale stranded, as is much of the cast. The worst film of the year.
That is so funny, because that was when we were still like doing like little practice pods before we started together, and I watched that. That was like my first film. I was like, oh shit, I gotta come on Adnan's podcast now and give a review of it. And that's the worst one of the year. I love that the film that you just threw out, like, hey, we're gonna do a practice pod, watch The Jesus Rolls, and that was your lead. Like, it's fitting. It's just,
and remember afterwards you were like, yeah, it wasn't bad.
I was like, yeah, decent. I was like, yeah. I was like, oh, there's some good names, Cannavale. This guy was weird. A lot of odd sex scenes.
Yeah, definitely. There was some odd menage a trois. as I mentioned, I've got to see The Tragedy of Macbeth, Denzel's new film. It comes out tomorrow. The documentary / animated feature called Flea, it's supposed to be amazing, and a movie from Japan called Drive My Car. It just won the Golden Globe for Best Foreign Film. So I'll get around to those. I know someone's saying, well, how'd you not include those? Well, you know what? We don't got screeners. It's a little tough right now. I got to go to the movies, pay my $37. So that's how it goes. So now we'll do the new
The Tender Bar did not make your top 10.
No, and let's get into the Tender Bar, which I did like. Available on Amazon Prime. Ben Affleck gives one of his very best performances as a kind, loving uncle who runs a bar which his nephew frequents looking for life lessons. The movie is directed by George Clooney, who does absolutely nothing visually interesting. In this adaptation of a beloved memoir by J.R. Moringer, there's nothing genuinely unique about the story. Boy overcomes working class Long Island to attend Yale one day. Deadbeat dad is an alcoholic who abandoned his wife and son, now a DJ in the city. He falls in love with a woman. It's on again. It's off again. But Christopher Lloyd, Dr. Emmett Brown himself, offers sturdy supporting assistance, including one scene where his flatulence is unstoppable, even as he attempts to deny he's the guilty party. Whoever smelt it, dealt it. See it for Affleck, though, as he's likely to receive a Best Supporting Actor nomination for a role that is tailor-made for his talents. I give the Tender Bar 2.5 Maple Leafs. More importantly, Chris saw it. I want your reaction.
I was into it. I'm with you. I enjoyed it. I didn't think it was great. It did seem like a story that's been told before. I thought that the entire film was going to be this kid trying to get into Yale, but at least they moved forward. I was glad to see that the story wasn't just about that, that like it got into his older years and, you know, but I thought that with the writing, you're right, visually, there was nothing really that Clooney did that did. But I thought that there was a bunch of one-liners, a bunch of quotable. It was like a quotable movie. I thought it was well-written. A lot of great music, a lot of classic music.
Steely Dan at the end, right? Do it again.
Yeah, dancing in the moonlight. It's your thing. Like, it was just classic, like, nice. It fit the vibe for what they were going for. I thought there was some the use of cutting at the end of scenes for comedic effect was used a few times that I really enjoy, where, like, they do a hard cut on, like, a funny moment, and then it's just, like, I don't know what that's called. I don't know the lingo, but I...
Are you kidding? You just impressed me by saying cutting. You could have said editing, but you went with cutting, which is even more specific film term. I like how they
back.
Cut.
Yeah, but I'm with you. When you had me at Christopher Lloyd, by the way. When I saw his head emerge from the trailer, I was like, okay, I think I'm going to be in on this movie. But you're right. I see Ben Affleck getting nominated for sure. Because it was just like, he was kind of like, I don't give a shit, but also I'm like really caring at the same time. Like, he had a nice like balance to him. You know, because sometimes those are tough characters to pull off, where it's like, I own a bar, but I'm also actually going to give you some good life information here.
Right. You might just think I'm just some bar owner, but look at all these books I got, okay? I've read like 30,000 books. Like, dude, I'm smarter than you think.
You got to watch your stashies. You got to watch your stashies. You know, like, there's, I mean.
Anthony Lane of the New Yorker, by the way, the gist of the critical response has been that the Tender Bar follows a well-worn path. Fair enough. But is that such a sin? And John Anderson of Wall Street Journal, the people are so familiar and the storyline so recycled that we viewers reflexively fill in the copious blanks in both narrative and atmosphere. But it's like bringing our own mortar to the filmmaker's collection of bricks. I mentioned earlier how much I love Ty Burr. He writes this watch list, which Chris, you know, stole a blurb from earlier.
Big fan.
He's got a great Affleck story in here. I've got to read. So he loves Affleck's performance, kind of like me. I think he gave it 2.5 stars. But as I said in that blurb, he loved him. I'll read more about it. The part's a perfect fit because Charlie is smart enough to see how life could have gone for him while turning the fact it didn't into a kind of enlightened blue-collar acceptance. He's the most well-read guy in the bar, and he's the guy who owns the bar.
Yeah.
But he's still a guy in a bar. And his performance captures both the man's pride and his understanding of waste.
Yeah, that's good. You ever fucked in a Volvo?
What a way to just blow things up when you're trying to meet your girlfriend's parents.
That was one of those ones where they went from him asking that to just like cut real fast to him walking like out, like as if like, okay, that was the end of that.
That's how you drop the mic. A final tale from Ty Burr. I interviewed Affleck back in 2012 during the press tour for Argo, the film about the Iranian hostage crisis that he directed and starred in. As a representative of the region's paper of record, I was able to have a one-on-one with him in a hotel meeting room while the rest of the journalists had a group roundtable. This was Boston, remember, his hometown, where impressions are important, where you should never ever think you're better than you are. With me, the Boston Globe reporter, Affleck was thoughtful, erudite, and humble, letting me know he'd majored in Middle Eastern studies in college, but also making clear he'd never graduated. With the roundtable journalist, I found out later, he was slouchy and profane, swearing up a storm, acting like one of the guys. He was acting, in other words. He was insecure. He wanted to be who he thought we wanted him to be. That need to be liked lies behind the false front of every smiling celebrity. Indeed, it's the subtext of fame itself. Somehow with Affleck, it became the text. The mask most stars keep firmly fixed in place on him keeps slipping, which makes some people nervous and a lot of people scornful. Somehow, It just makes me like him more. As a celebrity, Ben Affleck is not great. We've seen him be an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. The whole issue with Bennifer, he's back with J-Lo now, like Jennifer Garner, Bill Sarver. Like, he ended up being a good actor who won an Academy Award for writing Good Will Hunting to making a ton of bad movies. But then he was a great director, and Argo won Best Director. Like, his career, phenomenal in terms of the highs and lows he's had.
It is a roller coaster. I'm trying to think of like a comparable, like an actor that's had a similar path. It's been all over the place. But I think he's found, I've seen him interviewed. He's in a good place in his life now. Like, he's not drinking anymore. He's being a good parent. Like, it may not have ended well with Jennifer Garner, but I think they're co-parenting. So it's, he seems to be in a better place now. And I've always kind of liked Ben Affleck, so I'm happy for him.
I've always liked him too. I feel like, especially you and me, if we hung out with Ben Affleck, he'd like us. Exactly. Big sports guy, likes to gamble. He used to like to get after it, but I think we would just hang out and talk baseball. Yeah. Like, I think he would generally be a good guy and a good guy to hang out with. That is the review there of that film. Couple more here. The Lost Daughter, which is currently available on Netflix. Story of a mother on vacation on a beach who can't escape the demons of her past. Slow to befriend another family led by the young mom, Dakota Johnson, she inexplicably steals that mother's doll. The movie undercuts lots of flashbacks to Jesse Buckley as the young mother, so playing Olivia Colman as a young mom, including a drop-your-jaw scene where she masturbates in front of her computer before her two young daughters barge in and interrupt her. Colman is a talented actress, and her scenes of burrowed grief showcase why she's destined to be nominated for Best Actress Academy Award. But I found the movie to be underwhelming, and the climax is a genuine disappointment. Two Maple Leafs, currently available on Netflix. If a film is called The Lost Daughter, you're going to say, well, what happened? How did she get lost? Has she been found? Those simple questions, I will tell you, are disappointing. It's available on Netflix. I can't imagine you sitting through The Lost Daughter.
The funny thing is this morning, before we were recording, I was like, I have a window here. I want to watch one of these movies. I haven't contributed shit to this podcast all year. So I was like, I need to come like with a movie scene today. I turned on that one because to me, Netflix of all those things is like the easiest thing to get to. So I was like, throw it on. I watched the very first scene where she's just walking out onto the beach and she like falls onto the ground, a very dark scene. And I just was like, you know what? I think I'm going to watch The Tender Bar. I watched literally the very first minute and I was like, I can't do this for 2 hours. I'm going to watch The Tender Bar. And I switched it to that one.
Very wise choice by you. I had a professor back in film history at Ryerson where I went to college, and he goes, any movie, they got to grab you within 10 minutes. If they are not grabbing you in 10 minutes, there's no reason to keep watching. And I go, there's going to be a couple along the way. Like maybe Lawrence of Arabia, it's a 3-hour, 40-minute movie, takes a little while. He goes, 10 minutes. If it doesn't grab you in 10 minutes, go do something else. I think it's a pretty good rule of thumb.
I like
and
that.
For Chris Cody, it's 1 minute.
Yeah.
one more for you. Swan Song, the gloriously talented Mahershala Ali, 2-time Academy Award winner. He shines in dual roles in the futuristic film on Apple Plus. A dying man is given a choice by kindly Glenn Close. Since his days are numbered on Earth, allow a complete replica to take his place. The catch is he can't tell his wife and son that his time on Earth is expiring and he's being replaced. The reliably brilliant Ali, previous guest on Cinephile, allowed to dance along the acting spectrum, dignified and sad, raging with fire at his clone, and firmly imbued with a sense of peace and calm. It's one of his best performances. It's an excellent film. I give it 3.5 Maple Leafs. If you knew you were dying, not to get morbid again, would you want a clone Chris Cody to take your place? Or would you be selfish and egotistical and say, no, if I'm out, Chris Cody's done?
I've generally not been a big clone guy. I don't like someone to like represent me. Like, you know, I feel like I feel like I do okay on my own, and I just don't know. Is he going to be exactly me? Is he going to say the same
exact
jokes as
replica?
Me? Is he going to be as quick as me? Like, I guess
not
it's
as quick as you.
I love how like I have me as this like quick witty person, but okay. You know what? You've talked me into it. I'll do a clone. If I'm going to be gone anyways, I mean, shit. I mean,
pretty soon, Cinephile is going to be the attack of the clones. It's like, why not? Hey. Your wife and daughter will be happy. Maybe it's even a better version of Chris Cody. Who knows? We're pro clone here.
You mentioned a threesome earlier. I mean,
yeah, that's true. Then the clone gets—it's a freaky clone. To review, The Tender Bar, 2.5 Maple Leafs. Swan Song, 3.5 Maple Leafs. The Lost Daughter, 2 Maple Leafs. Those are your new films.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Pleasure to be joined by Chris Mundy. He is the showrunner of Ozark. That's right. You all know and love the show. Friday, January 21st, it is the final season. It's being split into two parts. Part one comes out then, I believe, 7 episodes each. It's going to be awesome. Chris, I guess this must feel like Christmas Eve in some ways. This great, great show is finally coming to an end. How are you feeling?
Yeah, I'm glad it's finally going to get out there. We made it a while ago, or we wrote it a while ago. We just finished up filming in November, but it just feels like I'm glad people can finally see it. It's exciting. It's like sad and exciting all at once.
Yeah, I want to go back to the beginning. As you said, writing it, being an executive producer, how did you first have involvement with Ozark?
I was working on a show called Bloodline that was on Netflix.
Ben Mendelsohn.
Yeah, exactly.
Key West show. I love that show. I love that show.
Oh yeah, it was great. It was I wasn't running that show. I was writing on it. But and they kind of came to me with it, and I said, "Oh, look," because the pilot had been written. Bill Dubuque wrote the pilot. I didn't write the pilot, and so. And they wanted me to think about taking it over or, you know, running it because Bill lives in St. Louis and he does feature work. He hasn't worked in TV. And I just couldn't do it. I said, like, thanks. It looks great. I'm finishing Bloodline. And it just kind of kept creeping back for months and months and months. And until finally I'd met Bill, I'd met Netflix, as I obviously already knew them. I'd met MRC, the studio. And they're like, well, why don't you take a meeting with Jason? And it's like, and suddenly it was getting close enough to the deadline of when they wanted me that I might be able to do it. And as it turned out, Jason and I, our daughters were in school together, but we didn't know each other at all. So I basically said, like, look, someone needs to tell him that I'm a face from grade school drop off, because it's going to be really weird if I walk into that meeting. And I was supposed to meet with him on like a Thursday, and I'm dropping my daughter off. They were in third grade at the time. Him and his daughter and mine, and I just get this tap on the shoulder, and I turn around, and we talked for like an hour, and then we met the next day, and then that was just kind of it.
Oh, that's a great story. I remember years ago when I had kids, and my wife and I had moved, I was like, you know, it's hard to get new friends. Like, how do you get new friends when you're an adult? She goes, you'll become friends with the parents of your children's friends. Like, that's how these things work. And for you, work has been created by the fact that, obviously, you're going to get the job anyways, but that association comes through as well.
I know, it's very funny. And luckily our kid's school goes all the way to 12th grade. So luckily he and I really have liked each other and it's gone well, because otherwise it would be uncomfortable for a lot of years.
Well, the other part I was going to say, let's hope the daughters always get along. Like, that's the other thing. Exactly. Imagine they're really close, all of a sudden they split apart. Like, oh my God, baby, we got to figure this out. This isn't good for either.
They've actually become like really, really close friends, as it turns out.
Oh, that's awesome. Part of what is great about Ozark, Chris, is how good Bateman is. And the fact that he's an actor who, listen, Arrested Development's one of the funniest shows of all time. I love the show. I love the fact that he's stretched in different ways. Like, Bad Words was an example where he directed it, showed a little bit of a meaner side of Jason Bateman. But Ozark is full. This is a drama. This is no semblance of Jason Bateman, comedic star. This is a drama. This is a tragedy. What is it about Jason, at least in your conversations with him, what did you get a sense of that he finds so attractive about the role?
You know, I think initially he really thought of it so much as a director. I mean, they came to him as an actor, and he said, like, I'm willing to think about it as an actor if you'll let me direct it.
Yeah.
Because he's a great director.
Yeah.
And then I think at first he was a little wary that it was too much like the Jason Bateman character. Like, you know, he always says he's very good at being sort of like the audience, like the everyman, and letting things bounce off him. But his timing comedically is so perfect, both on film, but also just in real life. And I think he was worried about it being almost like too easy and just that. And so he wanted to make sure he could stretch it and be a stretch like his director side, and then make his director side push the actor in him to do more dramatic stuff. You know, it's been I've kind of watched it seamlessly happen, and he's great at both.
Yeah, he's a guy that definitely is showing his range in this show. I've talked to Will Arnett a couple of times on this podcast. Of course, he and Bateman are close friends. Will's a big sports fan. He's a huge Toronto Maple Leafs fan, loves soccer. Bateman, of course, diehard Dodgers fan. The funniest anecdote that Will told me, I go, give me something about Bateman. He goes, listen, he's got two daughters. He's super busy. He's not just a star in Ozark. He's a director. He cares about it. Because that guy loves the Dodgers so much. He gets up at 5 a.m. He's DVR'd the game. He watches the game before he goes to work. I said, that's not true, because it's absolutely true. Can you confirm?
It's totally true.
But, yeah, okay.
It's totally true. He watches the game. He'll watch him sometimes on like time and a half. Right. Do you know what I mean? Like the speed, depending on where I'd get there and like go through. But yeah, exactly. But he does. He's like, it's crazy.
I love when people are that passionate about sports. I can just imagine you're shooting in Atlanta or whatever. He's like, guys, got to wrap up here, okay? The game's starting soon here. Like, that takes forever. It's fine.
We called the set at like 6 a.m. and like our locations, like where the Birdhouse and the Langmuir Trailers and all that is, that's like 45 minutes to an hour north of the city. So like, you know, he's got to leave at like 5 a.m. It's like crazy. Yeah.
It's amazing, the passion. The whole cast is great. Let's talk a little bit about Laura Linney. I just watched that great film, The Savages, because it's the 15th anniversary. Her and Philip Seymour Hoffman. I love that film. It's on HBO right now. So they're re-airing it. And for those who haven't seen it, it's a wonderful film. It's about a brother and a sister dealing with the fact their father's dying, putting him in a nursing home. But it just reminded me how much I love Laura Linney. And she did those great independent films. You Can Count on Me is another good one. But Ozark has been such a great role for her. Just talk a little bit about Laura Linney, writing for her, working with her. What's that been like?
I mean, I think, and this sounds like something you just say, and it's not an exaggeration at all, is the day Laura agreed to sign on, which was a real leap of faith on her part, because you didn't know what that character would be or could be, and she needed to trust me, and she needed to trust Jason, and thank God she did. But the day she signed on kind of put this, like, terror in all of us, like, oh, we've got to be good enough to justify Laura being in the show. You know, so I think just that she brings a level of preparedness. Like the way she breaks down a script is like, she's taught all the other actors on the show the way she breaks down a script. She reads the script every morning before she goes to shoot. Not the day's scenes, but like the whole thing, just to contextualize. She's so thorough, and yet she's like this incredibly like nice, giving, easygoing person. It's not like, she's not one of those people that stays in character and like, you know, brushes people off. So I just think the combo book of like her being a presence on set that is nothing but positive and giving to everyone, but then also showing up with like your A game. You can't play like crap if Michael Jordan's on your team. He won't, you know, it's peer pressure. So I just think it ups everybody's level.
Obviously, all the scenes of her and Bateman are great. Just the fact the Bird family is getting in deep. But then you add the brother. And I mean, it was such a different, I don't want to say sleight of hand, but just a different evolution in her character. The scene where she's going to give her brother up, I mean, that's as good as screen acting gets. Tell me everything about that. I don't know if you wrote that episode. Were you on set that day? Tell me everything.
I did not write that episode. Mickey Johnson wrote that episode, and she wrote the hell out of it. We obviously all broke it together. But I think that episode is as good as anything we've ever done. There's a scene of them in the car together at the big parking lot where they stayed overnight, where they just talk about the life and the future too. That's just like devastating. And then that scene, obviously, in the diner, and then when she gives him up. I think she brings so many different dimensions to it all. So in one way, you actually understand she's doing this terrible thing. Obviously, she's doing the worst thing that anybody could ever do, and the reverberations from that carry on for the rest of the show and all through season 4, both parts. And yet, in that moment, because you've watched it all and you've watched her, you feel so sorry for her. I mean, and how does someone pull that off, right? So I wasn't on set the day we did that. But I remember the first time I watched it in the editing room, it was just me and Vix Patel, one of our editors. And we watched it. He put the lights back on in the room and I was bawling, crying. And he just looked at me and goes like, right? And I'm like, yeah. It's just stunning. And from there you get to build off that. Everything we built, the way we edited the final episode, which I wrote, was based on her performance in that scene, basically, you know? So suddenly it's like a gift that keeps on giving.
You're not the only one who was teary-eyed. I remember watching it, being choked up with my wife, like, oh my God, it's just, it's heartbreaking. It's as good as acting gets, and thank you for sharing those personal remembrances of it. Julia Garner, I remember her sharing about the show, and they go, okay, it's kind of like when you go to a movie, and you go, okay, I'm seeing it for Bateman and Linney, but I walk out and go, how about that Julia Garner? Like, she just steals the show. And I'm like, I think it's one of those characters, Chris, it could go wrong, because you could go, all right, tough-tacking, sassy, not going to take any shit, right straight out of His Girl Friday. But she has different elements to it, and there's different pathos as well. I just love what she's done with it and the way you guys have written that character. Talk about the evolution of what Julia's done with that role.
Yeah, and I've said this before, so I apologize for repeating myself, but like when we were in the writer's room, like that character was our favorite character to talk about. And it just kept growing. We just became in love with her. This was before Julia was cast. And I didn't know Julia's work. So the first time I ever saw Julia was in her audition. And first time I ever met her was like in a room when she read. And so for us, if whoever played Ruth hadn't been really good, it just would have been devastating, because we've kind of felt like this to me is like bringing out the heart of this place. And then Julia was so much better than we ever could have even imagined. And the second you saw her on screen, it was just like, it did. It was like, it was kind of like everything like went fuzzy and she got bright and you just kept, and you watched her. And so it was so rewarding just on a writing level to get to know we could do that. And then it really became like, okay, how do we, the show instantly went from being Jason and Laura to Jason, Laura, and Julia in the way we thought about it. And we always thought about it in terms of classes and the birds being these sort of like this invasive species that came in, and then what happens to the people in the class of the Langmuirs. And so suddenly she embodied that so much, and she's so tough, but Julia plays it with this sadness underneath. And so like that combination is, even when she's, you know, talking tough, you feel insecurity and pain too. And so, you know, it's not this one-dimensional character. It's really great. And then the way we write her, you can find her. Every time I got back to a new season, because I'll always write the first episode of the season, you instantly can write Ruth. So we, like, you just fall into the rhythm of it, and you hear like what Julia made, and you can just write it. You know, it's just instantly there.
It reminds me, when I've talked to other showrunners, like David Chase has said, the character we all love writing in The Sopranos was Uncle Junior. Because he goes, Junior just had one line after one liner. So it's like, I can imagine for you guys, you're okay, Ruth is one that's fun, we can dive into. And that totally makes sense to me, that once you hear the character's voice and you see her, it makes it even more easier to kind of to transcribe and put the character in that direction.
Yeah, and it's funny, it's when we got new writers, everyone would make the mistake first of writing her kind of like yokel-like, but like she's not at all. Like it's a subtle difference, but I mean, everyone always eventually like clicked into it right away, but it's not that. There's just like a directness and a harshness, but like, you know, it's like that combination. It's the why she listens to like classic hip hop at the same time she's like living in a trailer in Missouri, you know?
Exactly. As a showrunner, as a writer, executive producer, you're coming up with these scripts, okay? The Bird family's getting in deep, they're getting painted in a corner, they got to get out of it. You don't tell me specifics, but are there times that there have been ideas bandied about and you go, okay, that might be going a little bit too far, we got to reel that back in? There's a really great sense of realism on the show and suspense, but all of it seems genuine. Is there a time that you guys have said, okay, I don't think that left turn is going to work?
I'm sure there are, but no big ones that kind. You know, there's probably stuff that like just instantly in the room we were just like no.
Right.
But I found that when we had debates about big swings, there was one in season one where whether or not Marty would give the baby to Darlene. I mean, we went round and round about that. And there are people in the room, you know, who I love, who are just like, no one will ever watch a show again, or everyone will hate him so much if he gives that baby away.
Yeah.
And we did it. And you know, we knew Wendy was gonna have Ben killed. But it's like, well, will anyone ever look at her the same again? I think we, every time we've pushed it, I think we've succeeded, at least by our standards. And a lot of that is just a testament, not to us as writers, it's really a testament to the actors, because they humanize those people so much that, you know, I use Jason as the perfect example. It's, the show started And the defining act of it, this terrible thing that had happened, it was 10 years before, like when he decided he'd sign on with the devil. And I think you didn't watch him evolve to it. He was just already, and if Jason wasn't so naturally likable, people never would have gone with him from day one, and he just is. So we had that, we had already banked that, you know, and I think some of that happens with how good Laura is, how good Jason is, how good Julia is. I mean, everybody across the board, we've been super lucky.
We've been immersed in this golden age of television, and so much of it is men behaving badly, whether it's The Sopranos or Breaking Bad or Mad Men, and your show is a great extension of that. And it's not just men behaving badly, it's women as well, and Wendy and Ruth and all the rest of it. It's funny because, you know, we're in a tough time right now. We all know that. And yet the show is so great. And this goes against the theory that you want escapist entertainment. Like, obviously, I went and saw and loved West Side Story with my wife because it's a beautiful musical and Spielberg's with a throwback and all the rest of it. But this show is so gritty and realistic. It still has such a natural and loyal following to it. What do you think about this terrain? The fact that you guys have taken, like I said, just the men behaving badly, you know, film noir, gritty yokels, et cetera, and you've been able to subvert the genre and yet extend upon it.
You know, in my mind, I know that the crime part of it is the engine that keeps it going, and it's the bells and whistles of it, all of which I love. I'm a huge fan of that stuff. But really, we think about it as a show about a marriage and a show about a family. And I think that's the thing. I think at its heart, we try really hard to have something recognizable about your own marriage, something recognizable about your own family. Obviously, you know, hopefully, you know, 99.9% of our viewers aren't doing the things the birds are doing, but
a little embezzling on the side, Chris, we've all done that. Okay, go ahead.
but I do think that there's this humanity inside that. And then we're able to write it just the tiniest bit. Arch is even too strong a word, but just the tiniest bit elevated because we know we're going to act it and direct it more like tethered to the ground. And I think that balance makes it fun at the same time it's dark. And the family, even though they're doing bad things and being terrible parents, there's like a love inside that you kind of recognize. And whatever that fusion is, I think is, you know, I don't think it's something that's necessarily brand new or necessarily something that we're the only people that have ever done. But I think that quality is what makes people appreciate it.
Absolutely. It's a family drama at heart. Like you said, the criminal aspect is an element of it. A couple more, and I'll let you get out of here. Criminal Minds. I got to ask you about Joe Mantegna, because I love Joe Mantegna. I love him because I love Mammoth. So all those early, you know, Speed the Plow and Glenn Gary, Glenn Ross on Broadway. Give me some stuff on Joe Mantegna. I love that guy.
That guy is just like everything you would expect him to be and think he was. I mean, and honestly, he stepped on the show in a really tough situation because Mandy had left. Right. And you know, we didn't know what was going to happen. He came in and he would show up to work. He would be a gentleman. He'd be super prepared, but also the nicest guy. And then all he wanted to do, he and his wife had a restaurant called Taste Chicago in the Valley here that just sold like Chicago. It's like deep dish pizza, you know, brats and things like that. He wanted to do his work, be awesome to everybody, and then go to Taste Chicago with his wife, like, you know, in the best possible way. Like the other thing I remember, we did an episode where we filmed on the, in the yard at San Quentin. And there's 1,000 prisoners out there that are just real prisoners. And, you know, like I talked to a guard, this one guard was talking to a guy and the three of us started talking and we all chatted and the guy walked away and the guard was like, he murdered his sister. And I was like, oh, interesting. And there were only two guards on the whole, on the grounds because they don't want too many down there. There's people up on the wall. So it was kind of scary when you first walked out there and everyone, no one really knew what to do and was kind of huddled. And Joe just walked over, like still he had this trend here, like dressed in character. He had like a long black trench coat on and just started talking to a group of prisoners. And then everything was kind of okay.
Wow.
He just like literally just went over and like shot the shit with a group of guys and was just like, okay. And there you go.
I love that. Joe Mantegna, cool guy from Chicago. Any situation, he's handled it. He's seen it before.
Yeah.
Last one for you. You worked for Rolling Stone. Is that right? For a number of years? What was that experience like?
11 years. That was the best gig. It was great. I was so spoiled. And it was also like, I was there for pretty much all the 90s. So it was a great moment where I got to, like, I'm a huge music head. And so, and it was a time where the music that was popular at the time actually was music that I cared about. You know, it was all the things that came out of punk rock. And, you know, I got to go on the road with Nirvana when Nevermind came out. And wow. I got it, you know, and things like that. So not only was I happy getting to write, but I was at a certain place at a certain time that that meant something to me too. So it was really great. And once you leave that place, everyone I know that worked at Rolling Stone that leaves it still thinks of themselves as part of that place. Do you know what I mean? It's something that just that gets inside you. And everyone I know that like I consider them all like coworkers, even the ones I wasn't there with. You know, it's weird. But
yeah, our boss John Skipper used to work at Rolling Stone for years before he went to
music. Yeah.
So like Skipper's got stories for days. That's the biggest thing. What's so funny is a music guy. I'm like, favorite type of music. He's like reggae. I'm like, was not expecting reggae to be the answer.
I would not picturing John Skipper. That wasn't where I was gonna go either.
I was like, I'm gonna go with jazz. He's like reggae. I'm like, okay, well, you surprised me on that one. Because you mentioned Nirvana, I grew up in the 90s. I was ages 12 to 21 in the 90s. So Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Soundgarden. You mentioned seeing Kurt Cobain. Top three concerts ever? Can you give me a top three? I'm sure Nirvana would be in that list.
Yeah, I saw Nirvana the night Nevermind came out, which is hands down one of my top three. I saw the Replacements when they were touring on Tim and Bob was still in the band in Providence, Rhode Island, which at this place called The Living Room, which is just this hole. It was just crazy. And they were like, They're drunken selves, but also it's still like good enough to play fantastic. Those are the first two that always come to mind.
Replacements, anybody, that's good. I like
anybody
that.
Anybody says something, and then probably I saw a Pogue show on New Year's Eve once. That was crazy, just because the Pogues on New Year's Eve being upright was something, and the crowd itself was so insane. So I probably those, but there's like, you know, there's hundreds more.
Yeah, there's definitely good choices. I love it. Chris Mundy, he is the showrunner, writer, executive producer of Ozark. Friday, January 21st is the final season. Part one is then, I believe, 7 episodes each. Can't wait to dive in and see what happens to the Bird family. They all do a phenomenal job, the acting, the cast, and, of course, the writers like Chris. It's an awesome show, Chris. Congratulations on all your success.
Oh, thanks.
Thanks for giving us a few minutes with us.
Yeah. I hope you like the season.
All right, thanks so much to Chris Mundy, the showrunner of Ozark. Obviously, very popular show. Make sure you check it out. Old movie this week? How about Ted? I was kind of surprised to look up. It's the 10th anniversary. That film came out in 2012. It stars Mark Wahlberg, 2-time guest on Cinephile, perfectly cast as a loutish Boston fella. The star, though, is a bear who is the antithesis of the lovable Teddy Ruxpin of yesteryear. He's horny, he's crass, and he's brought to life by the multi-talented polymath Seth MacFarlane. The reason I want to talk about Ted is I want to talk about Seth MacFarlane. I find the guy fascinating because, like me, he's got an old soul. Like, he loves the crooners. He loves Sinatra and Dean Martin, all that stuff. He's released a Christmas album. Yeah. Like, he has one of the best renditions I've ever heard of Baby, It's Cold Outside. I listen to it all the time. Like, man, MacFarlane, like, in a different
really?
Era. No, yeah, in a different era, he'd be like Michael Bublé. Like, MacFarlane loves that stuff.
What?
I'm sure. Look up Seth MacFarlane, like, lounge singer. Like, this guy's
unbelievable. I can hear his voice. I can picture him being a lounge singer, but it's just funny that you've got him being Michael Bublé.
Good-looking guy. Clean cut. He's like Bublé. Like, MacFarlane could do it. But kind of like Bob Saget and Adam Burke, he's got this dirty streak to him, so he wants to make movies about profane bears, and he's done a show in Family Guy, which is, I think, one of the great success stories, whether or not you like the show or not, and I haven't watched it in years, to be honest. I used to really enjoy it when it first came out. But Family Guy was a show that was, like, off the radar, cult hit, canceled, brought back, and now I think it's been on for, like, 20 years. Like, I know The Simpsons is 30 years, whatever it is, but Family Guy alone, Seth MacFarlane gets such credit because he's voicing all these characters. Then there was whatever the hell, the American Dad spinoff. I mean, he's done some stuff that has not worked. Obviously, he did that Western, which was a huge flop. But the fact that he was able to make Ted about a talking bear and make it fresh and funny, the film made, like, $150 million. It was one of the biggest hits of that summer. If you haven't seen Ted and you're a fan of Seth MacFarlane, go check it out. I'm sure you're a fan of the movie, Chris.
I see, this is interesting. I of all the big time comedies growing up, Ted I would put in this category, and I, of all of them, I'm not It was a little too much for me with the bear. Like, you know, there's funny moments. There's great liners, classic Seth MacFarlane, like obscure pop culture references.
Yes.
And I'm a fan of Family Guy, but it's hard for me when I hear that voice. I just think of Family Guy. So it was a little difficult for me to love the movie. It seems like a movie would be right up my alley. Never a big Mark Wahlberg guy for some reason. I don't think he's like real believable in a lot of things. He just seems like a, you know, not a lot of range there. But it was just overall, I laughed at parts. I don't hate it, but believe it or not, not a huge fan of Ted, if I'm being honest.
I like the contrarian opinion. Because I pick out the old movie. If it's a comedy, I'm like, oh, Chris will be into this. I'm like, right, something about Mary, 40-year-old version. I'm like, oh, Ted. So I am, tell you what, Chris Cody surprised me.
I'm trying to throw a curveball. Look at me throwing a curveball.
You used cutting rather than saying editing. You don't care for Ted? I mean, my man is bringing something new here.
I said range when talking about Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah. You didn't just go, I don't think he's that good. You're like, I'm not really sure about his range. I'm like, that is something I would say. I'm not sure about his range. He does often appear to be playing himself, a Boston guy.
Yeah.
All right. How about the reviews of Ted? I have not gone way back to check. I really enjoyed it at the time. I haven't seen it multiple times. Ted 2, let's be honest, in fairness to Chris, Ted 2 is something nobody needed to see, but unfortunately some of us had to sit through. That was definitely not great. Another example of a director cashing in. Donald Clark of Irish Times, there's just enough mileage in the gag to keep the movie spluttering through an energetic series of pop cultural references, and broadly staged orgies of profanity. David Sexton of London Evening Standard, laughter doesn't lie. I loved Ted and found it irresistibly funny and hugely enjoyable. And Violet Luca, Film Comment Magazine, it is a film that seems to have an endless middle. That's a good way of chopping it up. A few more reviews here and we'll say goodbye. The Lost Daughter, this was from Stephen Romay of The Australian. This is a fine, unsettling film about the cost of the choices we make. Okay, and Alyssa Wilkinson of Vox, the end is deeply ambiguous, neither punishing nor condoning its character's behavior. It simply asks us to sit with them, to pay them the respect of attention, and learn something about ourselves in the process. See, that's like that classic pompous film criticism. Like, what are you actually saying? Did you like it or did you not like it? They're just using a bunch of words. And lastly, Swan Song. Carrie Darling of Houston Chronicle, it's Ollie's understated performance as both Cameron and the clone that makes Swan Song work. And Leah Greenblatt, I really like her, by the way, Entertainment Weekly, without much dramatic tension beyond the will he or won't he of Cameron's final choice, the film feels oddly inert, a melancholic iPhone ad stretched to feature length. Ouch! Not a fan of Swan Song. So once again, next week on Cinephile, The Tragedy of Macbeth, Denzel Washington, Frances McDormand. Chris might think they're joining, but I promise you, well, you never know these things. I'll see you at the movies.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.